It's the best of the 2010s of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a repeat of some of the best episodes from 2010 to 219. This time, anti-GMO fallacies, Irish water, faith in science, and the good of big data. Let's begin the best of Radio Free Thinker.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical. The
cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Talking about the precautionary principle and this notion of my fear overrules science segues nicely into our next anti-segment. And this is made news headlines around North America. Vancouver was host to a big protest over GMO foods, and particularly Monsanto, the sort of boogeyman of big corporations.
It is the Walmart of the farm, the agricultural food area.
Yeah, it's the Microsoft of technology.
It is the Apple of... Yeah, okay, let's...
No, we can keep doing that all day. Anyway, so this was part of a sort of, a global protest where they had roughly... about 57 countries, I believe, participated, and about 436 cities. So this was a pretty well-coordinated effort, basically saying, we're here, we don't want to deal with GMO foods, and we don't care about the science. We're concerned that, you know, we're being poisoned by big corporations. Now, we've actually sort of talked about this a couple times on the show, so I don't really want to go over what we've already said. So I wanted to talk about an article that I read on NPR about sort of the top five myths associated with GMO foods. And actually, we're only going to really talk about two because we don't have a lot of time. But it's a good article. I suggest you check it out. So the question we have here is, you know, why are people afraid of GMO foods when you think that with a population of about, 7 billion, we kind of need everything we have to feed all these people? We need crops that are going to last a long time, are going to have high yields, and are resistant to pesticides and pests and bugs and that kind of thing.
The whole host of things that can attack. I mean, right now with climate change, that's another big area where they're trying to do this sort of things.
Exactly. And I mean, after all, we have been genetically modifying our food since, well, ever, because that's what we do. We cross breed, we look for plants that last longer, and we select them and grow them. And so, yeah, we've been doing this for a really long time. But anyway, getting onto these myths. So this article written by Dan Charles, and one of the first ones that I think comes up often is that the seeds from GMOs are sterile. And the answer to this is actually, no, they're not sterile. They will grow like any other seed. Some GMO crops have what's called a terminator gene. And this is done for, different reasons, to protect patents, to control where they grow. I mean, we have things like invasive species. Some companies, Monsanto included, has a patent on terminator genes. They've promised not to use it. I'm sure they might break their word, but it's not like every GMO apple you buy at the grocery store has a terminator gene, and if it goes off, your head will explode or something. You know, we're allowing tiny grains of truth here to sort of sprout into webs of conspiracy. And I think it's important to keep in mind just what we're eating and sort of what's on the laboratory counter in some gene splicing place that's never really going to make it to our dinner plate.
Yeah, no, lots of times too. I mean, there's sort of a cost-benefit analysis, right? So if you have this terminator gene technology, sometimes there's a price to be paid for it. So you may get less yield, or it may be harder to handle or something like that. And I think a lot of that plays into sort of the calculation. So on the one hand, and actually the big issue with the sort of terminator gene idea is they say, well, this forces farmers to buy their seed from Monsanto, that they're not allowed to keep their own seed, as if this was 1840 when people did that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I was doing a little bit of research before the show on this, and it was a study about mainly about corn, but it was showing that actually from the 1920s, people were less and less doing this. And actually by the 1970s, over 90% of that particular crop, people bought their seed. Right now, it's much easier for farmers to sell off all their grain, buy the new seed. And part of the reason why is the genetic modification that we've been talking about. I mean, there is a real sense of that in the idea of hybridation. That when you plant a seed from a seed, like so you naturally pollinate it, right? It washes out the hybridization. So the thing that you wanted from the seed, you know, the big growth, the resistance to whatever, that was naturally occurring through selective breeding, eventually gets watered down if you keep your own seed. It sort of defeats the whole purpose of being in there in the first place.
Yeah, exactly.
So farmers are already buying all of their seed from these groups. There's no need for Monsanto to do this terminator gene. It doesn't need to.
Yeah, exactly. And Monsanto is sort of like the boogeyman of this whole web of conspiracies. It's just everything they do has some icky hands on it. And again, not to defend big corporations, because we don't really try to do that very often.
I just, on the record, I do hate Monsanto, not because of their practices of genetically modifying food, but I mean, they are a monopoly. They're part of the oligarchy. They do put in special laws just for them into legal things.
Oh, yeah.
There are so many great reasons to hate this company. This just really isn't one of them.
Exactly. So the other sort of long-standing myth is that Monsanto will sue you if you grow their patent GMOs, or if traces of those GMOs like enter your fields through the wind or something like that. And this myth is so prevalent, but it's not true. In fact, Monsanto has never sued anyone for trace amounts of seeds being blown over in the wind. There have been real cases where Monsanto sued farmers for actually stealing their crops, you know, like taking them and planting them.
Well, no, actually, there is a famous case in Saskatchewan, which when I first heard it, I was like, oh, this is like big corporations were real evil for doing this, right? Again, I wasn't against the modification.
Right, yeah.
But this was a horrible thing because apparently the original story was a Saskatchewan farmer, his corn was naturally pollinated by the Monsanto genetically modified one, and that it turned up in his crop, and he didn't try to do it. It's nothing to do with him. This was just nature at work. Well, apparently what he was doing was that when his seed came up, he would take Roundup and go around the edges of his field where his neighbors who were using this to kill off all of his crops and only those that had cross-pollinated with the Monsanto. Then he took these seeds, and this is what he was using to pollinate. So, granted, maybe a bit of a gray area. They were his seeds, so to speak. But he definitely knew what he was doing.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty sneaky of him. And what's interesting is I found out that in 2011, a group of farmers actually sued Monsanto, saying that GMOs might contaminate their crops, and then Monsanto might sue them for patent infringement. So they were suing Monsanto for something that Monsanto hasn't even done yet. And I can just sort of picture the judge in this case going, wait, what?
Yes.
And so basically they said, come up with evidence or a case where this has happened, and they couldn't. So the judge threw out the case. Now, I mean, I'm sure that if Monsanto wanted to, they could get around legal things. They're a big company. But again, as Don said, let's hate them for the things that they do and not things they don't do.
Well, and like one of the big things is, what is it called? It's Monsanto Atman. Monsanto Exclusion Act or something. It was just passed recently. Mm. And it was actually a rider put into one of the bills that says that, you know, if they want to grow a GMO crop, that even if the judge says you can't do it, they can still do it. Now, again, irrespective of that, you should be upset that they can get a law put into, like, it was a budget bill or something that had nothing to do with whatever they're doing. But I think another thing, too, that often comes up these days is that, you know, everyone says, well, you know, we need to know what's in there because everything is genetically modified in the sense of they're putting genes in from other animals that wouldn't get together in nature. And I was thinking about that. And it strikes me as weird. So this gene that was in a pig, and let's pretend we put it into a sheep because we wanted to make pig sheeps, which is actually something they want to do because they want the wool from the sheep and the, right?
Right, right.
So either you're implying that pigs are poisonous or sheeps are toxic. You know, because, I mean, I can't. There's no real combination of anything that pigs or sheep do. I mean, if you're crossing a bee with a crow, okay, maybe the crow would grow a stinger and that might cause some issues.
Yeah, or like a shark with an eagle or something.
Right. And the other thing, too, that's important to remember is that nature has a really good way of preventing, how do we put this, monsters from being created. I mean, the vast majority of conceptions, right, where, you know, sperm and egg meet and life is grown, are destroyed because the genetic combination in there is something that says, no, I don't think this is going to be viable, and it's sort of a self-terminating process. So even if we artificially put some genes into something that causes it to do X, Y, or Z, really there's a fail-safe built into it so far, where nature will just say, no, that is an abomination. It shouldn't live for one reason or another. And the idea that there are genetic crops everywhere is another fallacy. Okay, they're in some industries like corn, canola, yes, the vast majority of them. But things like tomatoes, which is interesting because there was a genetically modified tomato that they brought out that they thought would last longer, would be easier to ship. And it turns out that A, nobody wanted it because it's very tasteless. And B, there were some other costs involved in creating it. So they actually took it off the market. Everyone's worried about genetically modified salmon. And again, might be something to worry, but right now there is no such thing as genetically modified salmon on the market. Yeah. You know, wheat, there is no genetically modified wheat, unless, again, you refer back to hybridization. And there, yeah, there's tons of things we do. And if you really, really want to get paranoid about stuff, people may or may not be aware, but bacteria have the ability to transfer DNA amongst species.
There, really?
Yes. It's not everyone, but there are species of bacteria that have the capability of sort of, you know, they infected one host that happens to be a pig, and then they infect a sheep, and part of their ability to try and adapt and co-op with everything is they do bits of gene swiping. And so you get these natural genetic modifications happening in nature, which is,
well, nature's very judgmental about those sort of things, as you mentioned. There's one thing that I wanted to just quickly point out, and I saw this in sort of the local write-ups in the paper, and they sort of quoted the organizers and whatnot, claiming that there are serious health conditions, there are harms to the environment, but they never said what these harms or health consequences were. It was just sort of they parroted the organizers, and they didn't add anything to this. And I just find that very disturbing, you know? Like, I think they have a responsibility to say, well, what? What are these concerns?
Well, you know, because then they're just going to bring out that, you know, Phil, who lives down the street, he gets headaches whenever he comes near a salad, right?
Yeah.
So obviously, it's a genetically modified alfalfa in the salad that's causing that.
Yeah, the tomatoes in the salad are bombarding him with radiation or something. Well, okay, that's our rant on anti-GMOs. Let's go to a quick commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. I'll be back after this.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
So we've all heard about Irish coffee, you know, a little bit of Irish whiskey with a little sugar added to your cup of Java. Well, make way for Irish water. Yes, it's a copyrighted term of my own. Well, in what promises to be a controversial debate, there are rumors that the Irish government may be putting lithium into the public water system. At first I read this, I thought, well, I knew the Irish economy was really, really bad, but to the point of medicating the entire country? Maybe. Then, of course, I thought, nah, this has to be some kind of crank or joke or something like that. And then I did a little bit of research. And it turns out it seems to be legit. At least the idea of fighting depression and suicide rates by putting lithium into the drinking water. So what the article... So what did the article actually say? It was in the Irish Central, although it was published in a number of other areas as well. Apparently, a Dr. Mushji Bamji spoke at a mental health forum on the depression in rural Ireland. He's Irish, even though he doesn't have an Irish name. He came from South Africa originally. But he stated that research done in Texas and Japan showed that, to quote, there is growing scientific evidence that adding trace amounts of the drug lithium to a water supply can lower rates of suicide and depression. He went on to say that he believes that the government should consider a pilot project for a town in Ireland where lithium salts could be added to the water in very small doses and examine the results. Now, everyone might be saying, well, isn't that a little drastic? I mean, adding an antidepressant to the public taps that everyone drinks from? Well, he's got that covered. He pointed out that the Irish and many other places are already mass medicating the population by adding fluoride to the water. So, you know, there's precedent for it.
Although that's kind of a reach to go from fluoride to lithium. I mean, fluoride's more of a... It's not like a medication that you consume. It's a medication for your teeth.
Well, remember, we talked about fluoridation, and there are negatives to it if done.
Sure, sure, of course.
So, but I mean, the idea of doing something like medicating the people in mass,
right,
is not a new topic.
No, of course not.
It's a different kind of way of doing it. And he does point out that the doses that would be used are really, really, really small. So there's likely to be no any sort of secondary health issues or anything like that. It should be noted that hundreds of thousands of Irish people suffer from depression at almost epidemic levels thanks to the failed austerity economics Ireland tried to get out of the 2008 depression, which has ironically enough kept the Irish economy depressed, no pun intended. Research shows that during international recessions, the suicide rates increased by 25%. Ireland is the fourth highest youth suicide rate in Europe. Suicide is the most common death for those 15 to 24 years old, and accounts for more deaths than cancer and roadside accidents combined. Road accidents. On that note, you're actually three times more likely to kill yourself than to die in an automobile accident in Ireland. So there seems to be a good cause to try something, anything at the moment. So I did look into Dr. Bamji's background. He is a real doctor. I couldn't find any woo, quackery, or pseudoscience. So let's go back to the science. I mean, is this just sort of crazy talk, or is there anything really to this? In 2009, a study published by the British Journal of Psychiatry by Doctor of Medicine, a real doctor, Hiro Chaka Ogami et al., examined lithium levels in tap water in 18 municipalities in Ota Prefecture in Japan in relation to suicide standard mortality ratio, or SMR, in each municipality. They found that lithium levels were significantly and negatively associated with SMR averages from 2002 to 2006. So the findings suggest that even very low levels of lithium in drinking water may play a role in reducing risk of suicide to the general population. This builds upon research done in the 1990s in Texas by Gerhard Sauser. In that paper, they studied 27 Texas communities from 1978 to 1987. They found that counties with elevated levels of lithium in their water, ranging from 70 to 170 micrograms, there was a negative correlation between robbery rates, burglary rates, and theft. And yes, they did adjust for population differences, and they were statistically significant, so this wasn't cherry-picking.
Well, it's a 10-year study. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Subject to confirmation by controlled experiments with high-risk... Oh, yes, sorry. The authors of the study ended their article by saying that, quote, subject to confirmation by controlled experiments with high-risk population, increasing human lithium intake by supplementation or lithiation of drinking water is suggested as a probable means of crime, suicide, and drug dependency reduction at the individual and community level. So eventually they said, hey, let's give this a try. Lastly, in another study in 2011 in Austria by Kapsa et al., reported that the overall suicide rate as well as the suicide mortality ratio were inversely associated with lithium levels in drinking water and remained significant after they did a bunch of sensitivity analysis and adjustments for socioeconomic factors. They had studied almost 6,500 lithium samples measured from across the country. So again, they were trying to rule out correlation with causation. They were, you know, there was any confounding factors. They concluded their paper by saying, quote, in replicating and extending previous results, this study provides strong evidence that geographical locations with higher natural lithium concentrations in drinking water are associated with lower suicide mortality rates. And these are not alone. I found in my quick sort of looking around dozens of other studies that showed similar sort of results. So the science seems plausible. I would even say likely. The journals check out, the way they wrote up their papers was, you know, they highlighted the science and they weren't actually promoting a particular agenda. I actually hope the Irish government sort of takes this idea seriously and tries it out. I should point out that on the other side, as a note, that they're dealing with sort of natural variations of lithium in the water. I haven't found anywhere where they've actually purposely tried this in any of the studies. So in your water, you're going to get extra crud in it as it is. Some areas have natural deposits of lithium, and that's where it comes from in their water. I should also point out, for clarification, the doses recommended in these sort of studies are about 1 to 200 micrograms per liter. A prescription dose of lithium, though, if you're going to go to the doctor and get a dose, it's actually 1,000 milligrams a day. So in order to get sort of a similar quantity, you'd actually have to drink 10,000 liters of water a day to get a prescription dose. And again, I think we call that, drowning.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting, and that will definitely be – I'd be very curious if they could actually get this to happen.
Well, I think the big issue is going to be is not the science, because science seems pretty locked down.
Yeah.
But lithium is a loaded word.
Well, anything you put in the water supply, no matter what it is, there's going to be somebody who's going to scream about precious bodily fluids or something.
Well, to be fair, actually, Alex Jones had a rant about this a few times on his website about how this is proof – that they're trying to, you know, subvert the people's will and turn us all into zombies to work at Walmart or something.
Zombies who don't want to kill themselves.
Yeah, well, I wonder what the rate of that is. Have you watched World War Z?
I haven't, but...
Reviews are mixed on it.
We should maybe dive into that for a future episode. Let's go to a quick commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be back after this.
The best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Understanding empowers you.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
So, Ethan.
Yes.
You know, faith and science, are they compatible or not? Well, before you answer that, religious people have often sort of lamented about atheists, that without a belief in God, we are somehow diminished. One area that religious faith seem to have, there's no sort of secular equivalent, is, you know, those times of stress or when you're sitting there and you're, you know, about to die or something, you don't really have any source of comfort. You can't sit there and pray to your deity to save you or have some comforting thought that what comes next will be better. Well, there have been some attempts to probe this idea. It was thought that, you know, in the absence of religious belief, other belief systems, you know, humanism, political ideology, would help fill in the gaps. One set of researchers wondered if the actual belief in science itself could actually be some source of comfort. To test this idea, the authors of the paper Scientific Faith did two experiments. The first experiment is they selected a group of non-believing athletes. They then divided the group into half. One half were to play a high stakes game, think something like the Olympics. The other were sort of in a low stakes game, sort of think high school gym class. Prior to the game, they did some weighted surveys of each player. On a scale of 1 to 6, do you agree strongly or disagree with a set of statements? Now, two of the questions they start out with were sort of categorical questions. Sort of like, how much stress do you feel under right now? And how religious do you consider yourself? The rest were expressions of faith in science, such as, the scientific method is the only reliable path to knowledge. Science is the most efficient means of attaining truth. Science can only rationally... believe in what is one can only rationally believe in what is scientifically provable, and more like that. So, in the experiment, religiousness, you know, didn't have any correlation with stress. Obviously, there was one's belief in sciences was negatively correlated with religious belief, but we could have guessed that. But science and stress were correlated, so that the more stress you felt under, the more confidence you had in these sort of I strongly agree statements. The second experiment involved university students and staff. They were divided into two groups. The first group were asked to write about an experience of dental pain, while the other was asked to write about their feelings of their own death. Again, there was a strong correlation between belief in science and existential anxiety, i.e. fear of death. So it seems like that when we are faced with this sort of, you know, great life's question sort of thing, we fall back on what we know, and we know science is true, so we tend to put more strength in what can, you know, what can save us. Well, there's no God, but maybe science can save us, sort of thing. But I had a bit of trouble with the idea of using the term faith in there versus belief. Because faith is almost by definition believing something in spite of the evidence, whereas belief is I have reasons to believe this, and therefore, you know, I'm more out of it. So there's sort of the two aspects. One, was this sort of a false question to go after? But two, it's interesting that we do seem to substitute our primary life philosophy for that. Or have I misread it?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because depending on what kind of person you are, you may not even fear death. I mean, one example that I've sort of thought about myself is that death is absolute. Like, we kind of assume, for instance, that we're going to be around to experience it. But you and your death will never coincide, right? So it's one moment you're going to be conscious, the next moment there's not even going to be a you to feel anything. Right. So from that point of view, it's kind of a meaningless question. And if someone, I guess, sort of thought about it from that angle, might go, oh, it is kind of silly to be afraid of death. But if you don't have that angle to look at it, it can seem, oh my goodness, you know, existential oblivion, that's going to be awful.
Well, I don't know. I mean, to a certain degree, as animals, we have the strongest instinct we have is to stay alive.
Oh, yeah,
I
mean, for sure.
So even if you have this, I'm willing to accept death, that finality, as you pointed out, is somewhat startling.
It is. It is. I mean, you think about the universe without me. I mean, that's just... I would feel so bad for the universe.
Well, I know you couldn't live without yourself.
Well, precisely. But the other thing, too, is perhaps this is one of those things that as skeptics and humanists, that perhaps we need to do a better job of finding ways to examine our existence minus ourselves, perhaps removing the ego from it, and think about, well, if I were to cease to exist, what of my works and deeds would be left behind? I mean, obviously for us, we have this podcast. It's going to exist well after we do. We have the memories that we've created in our friends and family. We have things that we've written and completed and done.
We have a criminal record. Oh, I mean, never mind.
Well, some of us have that to aspire to. But yeah, there's much that we can leave behind that we can, I guess, be confident that we will be remembered and appreciated for. And I think that, you know, those of us who have children can say, well, part of me will live on. My genes will continue to multiply. So there are definitely things that we can point to and say, my legacy will survive, my mortality.
Well, so what about then the other aspect of this then? That it seems that there is an instinct to have a strengthening of our beliefs. I mean, so you have the, you know, the sort of idea that when I'm gone and poof, right? It's a non-event. Mm-hmm. But if you had taken this test, it's quite possible or probable that you would have expressed a stronger agreement with some of these statements. To be fair, I don't think I could have agreed stronger with any of them, but there is the possibility, you know, that... So what do you think that shows about the human psyche, that we seem to need something to comfort us, even if that something is not necessarily, you know, you have your beliefs, I have mine.
Well, I mean, science in of itself is not necessarily the right tool for that. I mean, if we're putting someone in sort of a stressful situation and then judging how much comfort they get from science, that could indicate that whether they appreciate the scientific method for what it can teach us, it does not offer them philosophical comfort. And again, like, that's not really the purpose of science either. So, I mean, perhaps we need to be considering other avenues of non-religious comfort, whether that comes from philosophy or humanism, or even just things like, you know, good works that you've done. If you, for example, talk to like an athlete and said, you know, look at all the trophies that you won, here's your name in the Stanley Cup, and here's your name up on the rafters, that kind of thing, you know, you may see a different reaction, right?
No, and I don't know. I think the idea, I mean, and it's often been discussed in the skeptics community, among others, about whether we have sort of a gene for belief. You know, religion. Yeah, why not, right? I mean, I mean it in the small r sense of the term.
Well, I mean, we're definitely not designed to think critically. I mean, not designed at all, but we're not.
Yeah.
Our brains do not favor critical thinking. They favor, you know, if you see a shadow, to run away, because we've been. That's evolution in works, right? We're not going to survive if we assume that, oh, that's just the wind, or that's just light tricking my mind. If we assume that's a tiger, or that's a ghost, or that's something scary, we should run away. That person's genes are going to survive.
So I wonder if the original religion was ourselves, and not ourselves as in me, but my tribe. That, you know, in times of trouble, right, I could call upon the other members of my community to help me. Because, I mean, that would make some sort of sense, right? You know, if I can rely on you, then you can rely on me. And anything that promotes that communalism would be a strength. But over time, as you mentioned, with the idea of us attributing causality to everything, or consciousness to everything, that, you know, lightning must be caused by God because it has to be caused by somebody.
You know, it's interesting. I've actually just been reading a book called Misquoting Jesus. And there was an anecdote in the book that kind of reminds me of this conversation, was that one of the unique things about Judaism and Christianity was that it promised a sort of reward for good behavior, whereas the polytheism of, like, Rome didn't really have that. They didn't get ethical guidelines from Zeus or Jupiter and, you know, the gods. They got that from philosophy and Socrates and Plato and the great thinkers of their time. Christianity and Judaism were unique in that it actually gave you moral prescriptions of what to do and how to live your life. And I wonder if we've kind of taken that to such an extreme in our society that we can only imagine that kind of, you know, either comfort in the face of death, but also sort of moral guidelines as coming from religion, when historically they've often come from the philosophers and the scientists and the wise men of the day.
Yeah, well, I don't know, because, I mean, I think another aspect that we have difference here is I think the Greek and Roman tradition were much more virtue-type ethics. So they were not; these are not rules to follow, but this is the kind of person you should be, which is why you get a very different when you go with the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition, because, sorry, that's another thing I've noticed lately, is a lot of people will sit there and they say, you know, Judeo-Christian, with somehow ignoring the fact that, well, Islam is part of that same tradition. It is the grandson of the Jews, sort of thing.
The reason I was using it in that way was because Islam, at the time of the book, Islam hasn't arrived yet. They're still talking about it, like, at the time of Jesus existing as a person.
I'm sure if we had a mullah here, he said the word was always there.
I suppose.
But maybe at this point, we should take a pause, and we can talk about bigger things than this.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR.
So, Ethan, we're going to talk about the good side of big data. We'll probably talk in a later segment about the bad side of big data, because that actually is a bigger topic in some ways, no pun intended. So we've all heard about big pharma, big oil, big sugar, big John. However, the new kid on the block is big data, and it's coming of age. How big is big data? Well, if you think about it, all of the data created since the dawn of awareness to 2003 equates to about, depending on your figures, about 5 exabytes. We now produce that amount every 2 days. That's big data. Mm. The amount of information generated in a day is 70 times more than that found in the Library of Congress. The amount of information each one of us faces in a single day is more than someone in the 15th century would have faced in their entire lifetime. So what is data? Well, simply put, it's a fact or figure that's been recorded, be it your age on an application form or the type of browser you're using that's stored in an electronic cookie. In the modern age, not only are we creating more data, both because there are a lot more of us around, but as well, computer technology has allowed us to not only measure more parts of the world, but to store it longer. So in a way, there's two aspects that's going on here. There is the creating of the data and the storage of the data, and then the processing of the data. So really three parts. In the old days, the only way to record data was to write it down. So you required a person, a pen, a paper, some time. Computers can do this all alone and in milliseconds. And our storage capacity has moved from, you know, a dozen data points on a piece of paper to billions on a memory stick. Let me give you a practical example. In the old movie days, you'd have sort of a cop tail a suspect. The cop would take notes every hour or so about where the suspect was, maybe what he was doing. And this would all go in, give you an idea kind of what he was doing and go into some report. But a lot of the minor details were missed. Now, you put a GPS tracker on them, you put in a wireless camera, record their electronic shadow, and you have a complete record of everything that the suspect was doing. Not only that, but this data is a lot easier to access. So in the past, if you kind of had a hunch, you had to go into, you know, the files, which sometimes necessitated a trip to go into a warehouse, you had to search through some index catalog cards, you had to find the box where the report was, and you had to read all the reports, hoping that you might be able to solve a cold case. Big data not only makes it as simple to search these records as I would do a Google search, but you can also set up things like flags. That is, you know, if a crime has three elements in common with a cold case, there'd be like a notification. The whole system becomes automated. In another more uplifting angle, a nurse will take a patient's vitals three or four times a day. It's not really practical to have a nurse constantly monitoring a pulse, but a digital recorder can accomplish that. It's able to record all your vitals every second and store them indefinitely. In a recent discovery in Toronto, where this data awareness was used to help premature babies. Well, first let me tell you that every day we kind of go through a cycling of cycles. So we have the fight and flight response where we kind of gear up all our responses. And then we have what's called rest and digest where everything kind of gears down. So on a normal day, we go through the cycle of going fight and fight, rest and relax, fight and fight, and we cycle through that. However, doctors notice going through all this data that the cycling would level off or there'd be a less of a fluctuation 2 days prior before a detectable infection. So big data was able to see an infection 2 days before the doctor could. And this, of course, will result in likely saving thousands of babies' lives. It's now possible to monitor everything every day. Any thoughts on that, Ethan?
Yeah, well, I mean, in one sense, you kind of have to go, we can monitor all this input, but how much of that input is valuable, like useful data? I mean, I'm kind of reminded of, remember the whole thing about Vic Taze and monitoring Canadians? And I mean, that's still kind of a relevant thing. But this notion of sending useless information, like I'm picking up the trash, eating an apple, throwing the apple away. There's a lot of junk data that has to be sorted through. I mean, we can accumulate data, but if we have no way of sorting it, of understanding it, of analyzing it, it's not useful.
And I'm going to go into that a bit later. And you are right. That's why I kind of wanted to, you know, there's our ability to get the data, the ability to store the data, and then the ability to process the data. And they're not all three advancing at the same time. But exactly on that idea is what you would call junk data. Mm-hmm. I was just listening on to one of my podcasts. They were talking about how air traffic controllers were really annoyed because they have all this sort of noise that's caused by bats and birds and bees and all that, right? And someone found out about all this data that they had, all this junk data that they had, who were researchers into bat migration. They're going, oh my God, you have all this stuff. It's gold for us. So you never really know what's going to be the trash and what's going to be the gold. And on sort of that note, I heard a very interesting analogy. And I'm not sure if you'll agree with this, but I liked it. So if we got a Visa bill, you know, and all it said was how much we owed, if there was no sort of itemization, no one would just blindly pay it. However, every month we pay the hydro bill without knowing any particulars of what we're paying for, i.e. what was the charge or cost of toasting my bread? How much was the load of laundry I did? Well, there's now actually available a monitor that plugs into your electrical system that can read the digital signatures of all your electrical devices and discern how much electricity each one's being used. Keeping with the hydro theme, another thing that the new Wi-Fi meters could help us do, who knows, is determine when we use our electricity. See, the cost of electricity is based on overall sort of current usage. So during a hot afternoon, AC running, doing your laundry may cost twice as much as if you left it for the night. In fact, there's actually dryers developed out there that will measure electrical usage and turn themselves on in the middle of the night in order to sort of take these savings. Now, of course, you would need to restructure more than just the meters and your dryers. You need to have this sort of minute-by-minute purchasing system available, and that's a whole other issue. But big data allows for better greening of our world by allowing us to see in detail not only energy usage, but help us adapt renewable energy sources to our grid. As mentioned, one of the obstacles to solar power, for example, is it's not available during the night and only available during the day. And most of that energy is actually in the mid-afternoon when the sun is stronger. If we knew in detail what appliances were the big users, we could use that during sort of this peak solar output and minimize our nightly power usage. Sort of the opposite of the Wi-Fi example, because right now we rely largely on fossil fuel plants, which sort of produce the same amount of power 24/7. So cost is not based so much on supply, like renewables, but on demand. One of the good things big data brings is the ability to do this, and something that was sort of impossible generations ago. Another area that big data is growing is in genomics. So it's now possible for a few grand to get your DNA sequenced. This makes it possible for us to tailor medical treatments. There are drugs out there that are actually quite effective at curing a lot of diseases, but for a small percentage of the population, it actually can be quite fatal because of some genetic anomaly. So big data will sort of allow us to sort of have our DNA profile on record. So we will know who's going to be at risk, and we can actually prescribe different drugs to those people while allowing the rest of them to actually use the cure. Of course, DNA data also has its controversies as well. And this was a really weird thing to come across, but big data is big data. First, we don't really know how to read it yet. We're getting better at this. This is part of the idea that Ethan was getting at, is that we have the information, but processing it has become quite difficult. Like I say, while I was listening to a debate about whether doctors should tell patients who have had a sequencing the total results, or should they withhold some parts of it. The argument for withholding was based on the idea that most of the genetic linked conditions that we know of, well, there's a lot of false positives for it, as much as 2/3. Mm-hmm. Also, for conditions that are incurable, I mean, aren't you really sort of subjecting the patient to unnecessary torment? The other side, of course, is that it's our data, and we should know what we can, as long as it's, you know, the appropriate caveats have been given.
Well, one thing that I guess has been in the news, mainly because of Angelina Jolie and her, she had her
double mastectomy
on because of a prediction for breast cancer. There's been a lot of talk about how much autonomy should the patient have in saying to the doctor, "I think I'm at risk for something. Do something about it." Is the doctor just supposed to say, "Well, okay"?
Well, and this is where you go with the idea that, you know, if we had a much greater certainty about the reading of the DNA, I mean, like I say, if there was a tumor in both of my, or one of my breasts sort of thing, right? And I went to the doctor, I would like it removed. Well, we go, "Well, yeah, sure, of course." But that's only because the certainty factor is much greater. At the moment, we don't have the same sort of confidence level in reading our genome than we do in this. So that's why I think a lot of that controversy arose. It's also another interesting thing, too, that came up with this debate, is that if you find out that you have this gene for cancer, because we're picking on cancer at the moment, what obligation do you have to tell all your relatives that this may be a thing in your family? Mm. And maybe those relatives don't want to know, because some people think, you know, "Hey, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die. I'd much rather live happily until that happens than in dread and fear."
Well, there's that movie that came out a decade ago. I forget the title of it, but it was about a future where everyone had had sorcerer DNA, and they all knew exactly what conditions they
Gattaca.
Were going to get. Gattaca, that's it. And it was kind of like the moral of the movie was, you know, it's taking all the fun out of life. And that's kind of a, I guess, pessimistic way of looking at it, because you could assume a more optimistic world where we learn to recognize what are likely outcomes, what are unlikely outcomes, and what are treatments we can devise to deal with these possibilities. So, and we're not going to get there unless we start doing the research, which means sequencing DNA and experimenting, right? So sure, we could take the mystery out of life, but on the other hand, we can maybe add 20 years to that life.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, hey, I got an MRI or I got an X-ray, and it says, "Hey, you got a tumor, and in about 3 years, you're going to be dead." Well, that's ruined the mystery of my life. I didn't. Now I know what's, you know, I So there's a tension between what we know and what we are misunderstanding, and that plays into that. But, you know, we're sort of fountains of data. With devices we use, the data about us, and they can provide. I mean, if you think about your laptop, right, it's got location apps, motion sensors, and the like. Did you know that the modern pacemaker records every heartbeat, every time it assists you? And it will upload that information to the manufacturer, who will use the data to sort of tweak the software on the pacemaker, potentially inform your doctor of some impending health issue. Oddly enough, of course, the ones that I know of, the manufacturer will not actually let you see your data. There was one gentleman who wanted to find out if there was something he was doing that was making his pacemaker go off. And he asked the company for the data, and they said, sorry, although your heart may have generated the data, it's our proprietary information, which seemed kind of weird. Another example where this sort of personal big data has surprising results is in a sensor carpet that can predict when you're going to fall. It's designed sort of for the aged and the infirm. Basically, what happens is it learns your walking patterns and will then signal alarm when a person is near falling. I can't quite remember whether it's going to tell you a day ahead of time, an hour, or a minute ahead of time. But what it essentially does is it monitors your walking pattern, kind of gets to know you. It will then be able to detect any slight variation in your stance, your gait, your muscle usage. Lots of little pieces of data that can be mined to make predictions. In an app developed by diabetes users, where there's a problem, you know, of them not taking medication during bouts of depression. Well, this app will track your activities and can predict 2 days prior that a subject is about to be struck with depression. It does this by, again, noticing the number of calls you made, your tweeting frequency, how far you go from home, how often. Again, lots of little pieces of data that can be used to predict, you know, the onset of depression. Any thoughts on that, Ethan?
It's interesting. I mean, again, there's so much calibration that would have to be put into something like that, that it's almost, your reaction is that it's impossible, that you just can't calibrate a device to fine-tune it to such an extent that it could predict things like that.
But it exists, and it does.
Yeah,
and
that's, I mean,
that's the other odd thing. I mean, we talk about with Facebook and all that, right, how you have thousands and thousands of friends on your Facebook or virtual reality, but we know almost, you know, intrinsically that the human capacity for friendship is only about 100, and that's based upon, you know, the biology of us growing up in thousands of years. And I think we lose sight of just, you know, how big data is and how it swamps us. The things that just that seem impossible. Well, we are getting the computer capacity to do the impossible. The computers have long ago outstretched a human mind, but they're even outstretching the human capacity for invention sort of in that sense.
Well, it's the processing power. I mean, if you want to take a really philosophical view and say that my Facebook profile is an extension of me, then artificially we are augmenting what evolution has limited for us.
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent the point. You know, the data that's being read here, it's not that we couldn't make these predictions. You said, you know, you'd have to get all this data and you'd have to correlate it, and it would be impossible for you and me to do this. But we now have the ability to get the data, to store the data, and to process the data to make these sort of things possible. And just to go sort of in another direction, some of our listeners may have heard of something called the Large Hadron Collider, which kind of makes me wonder, where in the world is the Small Hadron Collider? But sorry,
Texas.
I stole that joke. But the Large Hadron Collider is really the embodiment of big data. It has 150 million sensors that deliver 40 million bits of data per second. That's over 4 trillion bits of data every second that goes out to these things, if my numbers were right. That's a lot of data. But to make it useful, you need to filter it. So apparently out of like these 600 million collisions that happen there every day, only about 100 or so are interesting to science. Being able to get that kind of results, which it was just not possible in the past. It's not only the capacity to collect and store data, but there's the datafication of the world. And the first way this is happening is sort of the transformation of old information into big data. We have all probably heard of Google Books. This is, you know, an attempt by Google to take every book ever written and digitize it. Now, there are over 3 million scanned books. This means not only are the contents of these books now available, but research can be done on sort of the words themselves. By data mining these reservoir of previously hard to access data, researchers have been able to discover trends in social tension, discovery of a super mother tongue, and a lot more, which, again, was not possible a generation ago.
Well, just not possible on this scale. I mean, like for example, again, going back to that book I mentioned, Misquoting Jesus, analyzing the Bible to try to figure out who was writing it, whether a gospel was written by Mark or John, or whether it was someone 100 years later, and we can do this on a very small scale, human beings wise, but having this massive collection of data to analyze by computers, we can analyze entire works of an artist and understand these changing trends on a such a larger scale.
Well, and that's another big aspect of this. So I've kind of mentioned the three aspects of it, but one of the things that overlaps all this, because in one sense, you're kind of right. I mean, in the past, you know, they've been able to do things like this, but the cost and the expense and the time required, I mean, the discovery of the sort of origins of the Bible were several scholars taking their life's work.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So it was just, I mean, and it was just the one book. Now, because we have all this capacity, all this ability, we could do this in like a single moment for a number of books. It's our ability to do this cheaply and quickly that has sort of made this such a new paradigm for humanity. Another way of looking at the way the world is being datafied is the sources and type of information generated. If we think about the web, I mean, we know things like cookies and trackers and bots, maybe. If you're on your cell phone or tablet or PC, when you click on a website, not only are you sort of generating the root data point, the page you're going to, but you're also creating a lot of other bits of data, like the time of day, what type of device you are, where, what page you're coming from, what page you go to next. A lot of this data built upon data is one of the other aspects that's sort of caused a multiplying effect. Now, the dimensions of data have also increased. One expert likened it to sort of a cyclops gaining a second or third eye. Not only are you getting more data, but you're actually getting new dimensions of seeing that data and how that information is interrelated. Now, in the area of commerce, big data comes, you know, comes from big corporations. If you think about, you know, your corner store, and no, I don't mean a 7-Eleven, I mean the old-time mom-and-pop type corner store. In a day, you would have tens of sales. If business was good, a few hundred a week, and maybe several thousand over your lifetime. Walmart alone generates over 1 million sales transactions an hour. That's big data, and they're using it. Did you know, Ethan, what is a top seller, a big seller, I guess, when a hurricane's looming?
Hurricane chow?
You'd think. Batteries, you know, bottled water. It's Pop-Tarts.
Hmm.
Pop-Tarts. The data doesn't say why. But whenever a hurricane warning comes out, Walmart will push up the Pop-Tarts to the front of the aisle. And that's another important aspect to all this is big data is big on correlations, but not causations. And that's one of the areas that in the next show can be quite troubling about big data. Another great advance, well, depending on your perspective, is the ability for marketers and companies to target ads and promotions that you actually want. I mean, we all complain about spam, but I mean, if I'm looking for a new car and a pop-up ad says, hey, there's a new car, that's kind of good. Like iOS 7, we were talking before the show, you know, there's a new thing by Apple. Well, that's the kind of advertising maybe I wouldn't mind. And big data allows purchasers to sort of, you know, check my purchase history, cross-reference that with other purchasers and other activities we do, and sort of predict what kind of things I want. And this marketing has showed some pretty weird connections. Like, apparently people who buy hair dye also like kitty litter. You can insert your old cat lady joke here now. You have a good one, Ethan?
Not offhand, no.
So a funny thing, but perhaps foreshadowing our next show about the dark side of big data. So one day, a Target manager got an irate phone call from a father. He was very upset that Target had sent his teenage daughter a coupon book for expectant mothers. He assured the manager that his daughter was pure and a very good person and was nowhere near pregnant. The Target manager, of course, apologized profusely and said they meant no disrespect and it's a big computer that makes these decisions, and much groveling ensued. So apparently what had happened is that Target knew from other market research that women just don't like having baby flyers thrown at them. They're sort of like, you know, what, aren't you pregnant now sort of thing. So there's a lot of negative connotations with them. Just do it sort of in bulk. So Target wanted a better way to, no pun intended, target its advertising. In steps big data. It seems that based on your purchasing habits, like what kind of deodorant you have, what kind of moisturizer you use, etc., they could actually target expectant mothers quite accurately. Well, back to our father. As it turns out, a few days later, the father called the manager back, this time offering an apology. As it turned out, that after a very intense and frank conversation, the daughter in question was actually pregnant and hadn't yet told her father. So Big Data was right. But was it wrong for it to use this information? And again, we'll find out more about that in our next show about big bad data. But Ethan, what do you think about targeted marketing?
Well, I mean, it's kind of interesting. I mean, it's been around for a while. I mean, whenever you purchase something off, say, Amazon, they'll say, you know, people who bought this also bought that. And you would look and go, hey, actually, I do want that. And I will buy that too. And you, I mean, to a certain extent, it's good because I don't particularly like going to the store, searching aisles upon aisles for things and, you know, trying to figure out what it is I want. If someone can say, based on your shopping habits, here's what you probably are looking for, and that's what I am looking for, I will buy it. Thank you.
Well, and it's another way that in some ways you can sort of, you know, discover things. Hey, I didn't know about this. Especially, I imagine, if you're an author, if you're a reader, and you like Game of Thrones, right? And you find out that there's this other one called John Crick, the Dragon Hunter. And everyone who bought Game of Thrones really loved this book. I mean, what are the odds you've ever finding out about this sort of obscure book? Yeah. And here's a way for you to discover something that you may find very, very beneficial. I think a lot of times people get annoyed. The whole concept of advertising. I mean, you know, in one sense, I'm glad that the advertising I'm getting are much more targeted to me. But I'm still not 100% comfortable of spam itself, right?
Well, people don't like being sold things. I mean, it's just sort of a natural impulse that we have. And I think that there's the question of where are you being sold? People don't want to get ads on their Facebook profile. They don't want to get ads sent by Twitter. They don't want to get ads emailed to them in most cases. So I think that people are okay when they go to Amazon or when they go to eBay, they're okay with ads because, hey, I may want to buy that product. But you don't appreciate it when someone, you know, if Walmart sends someone to your house to knock on your door and say, hey, do you want to buy this? No, go away.
Well, and also I think it comes to is that, as we kind of talked before about with DNA and some other things, is that although our capacity to process big data is improving, it still has a ways to go. So, you know, and I mentioned sort of humorously this father who didn't know his daughter was pregnant. But I mean, I imagine there are quite a few people out there who got this coupon book that weren't pregnant and go, hey, what the heck is this happening? Because the data was processed incorrectly. And then you get a lot of inappropriate ads.
Yeah, exactly. We're out of time. So this is Ethan, your free thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose.